When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store or a snarky boutique, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Well, the president has picked a federal court judge to be the next jurist on the United States Supreme Court. Does he have your approval?
As much as I love former, Dick Cheney hacks,
John,
I'm a little dubious. Look, I can tell you something.
This is Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, I can tell you something about Brett
Impeccable,
Kavanaugh.
Impeccable credentials.
Yeah. He's a Dick Cheney hack. Can I say it in a more blunt way? Is there anything more I could add to it? I don't know.
What's wrong with Dick Cheney?
He's going to be in this new Sacha Baron Cohen
thing.
But, here's my little Brett Kavanaugh story. I had my big story, big analysis, lots of stuff up on Brett Kavanaugh within really less than an hour of when it was announced. I mean, very fast. And I'm a pretty fast writer, but way faster. You know why?
Long paper trail.
I knew Trump was going to pick him.
Really?
I didn't know, I wouldn't have put $100 on or something like that. But I anticipated the Trump pick and had actually written a lot of stuff and done a lot of research, talked to people in advance. Why?
I don't know. You tell me.
Brett Kavanaugh shares Dick Cheney's view of an imperial presidency. He is a guy who believes that the courts and the Congress should bend to the executive. As such, he is the exact right fit in the mind of Donald Trump for the Supreme Court. He was a pure natural.
So this goes greater than Donald Trump's immediate legal issues. This goes to even a wider swatch.
Without a doubt. I mean, there's some people who think, and there's been speculation, right? That Trump picked him because he's worried about Mueller. He's worried about the investigations and questions that could well come before the Supreme Court. Bloomberg News wrote about this, that, Kavanaugh's got more of a paper trail on some of this stuff than anybody else. And so if Trump was purely worrying about his own legal challenges at this point, Kavanaugh would have been the natural pick. But I take it much further than that. Kavanaugh is a guy who, despite the fact that he was involved in the Clinton impeachment as a hyper-partisan young Republican, he had his, kind of seminal experience, his core experience in the Bush White House and in the run-up to the Bush White House in the Florida recount fight of 2000. He was close to Karl Rove. He's close to Bush. Traveled in the circles of Cheney in that White House, to the extent that anybody can be close to Cheney. And he's literally stamped with the Bush White House attitude toward an imperial presidency. And remember, this is an important thing. Bush didn't simply use, authorizations of the use of military force in the broadest sense to, launch wars and do all sorts of stuff like that. He didn't just engage in illegal and expansive approaches to spying and assaults on privacy rights. He didn't just advance, massive increases in the security state. He was also one of the pioneers of signing statements. And if you recall signing statements, this was something that the Bush administration did. When the president signed a law that was passed by Congress, they'd attach these long statements saying, yeah, but my signing of this doesn't mean that this law will apply in this way. Well, you know who was floating around And this is very important to understand. Brett Kavanaugh comes from and has written about a sensibility that says basically the president is above the law, or at least is beyond the law.
Although, in fairness, he has said Congress needs to change the law to give him more power and make the president above the law.
Right, right. He's openly advocated for, that's a narrow thing. He has openly advocated
right.
for a change of the law to exempt sitting presidents from criminal inquiries and investigations. So you understand what that says is that if a president of the United States is clearly violating the law, if the president is committing crimes,
uh-huh.
if he's got a Congress that's aligned with him politically, so he can't be impeached, right, which is, of course, the circumstance we're in right now, or at least it's very unlikely he'd be impeached, that president can't be held to account by the legal system. That doesn't just put the president above the law. That makes the president imperial.
Wouldn't that be putting a justice on the Supreme Court that has a rather pre-1776 view of the Constitution?
It does. And you know what? This is and Kavanaugh,
now that's a Russ Feingold line, but I had to use it there.
It is a monarchical vision. King for 4 years, so to speak. Now, Kavanaugh, interestingly enough, he's smart. So in his writings on this, he said, well, some critics will say this puts the president above the law, but it doesn't. It merely delays accountability of the law, right? Well, Sly, let me offer you this notion. If you went out and committed a crime, would you like to be able to delay accountability for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
And on the possibility also that in those 3 or 4 years, attitudes might change, people might come or go. You know what I mean?
What's that adage? Justice delayed is justice denied.
Without a doubt. And so, I mean, by any reasonable measure, despite what Kavanaugh says and what his ridiculous, I mean, literally, like clown crew defenders suggest, you know, say, well, you see, he even said it doesn't put the president above the law. It'd be like, you know, you saying, Sly, yeah, well, I said that, but that doesn't mean what I said. You know, this guy is pure trouble.
He would have been rooting for Nixon.
Rooting for Nixon? I think this guy, you know, is the kind of guy who might have, you know, I've spent time on panels with, you know, some of the Watergate investigators and different people who are around that. And many of them will say that in the current context, it would be much harder to hold Nixon to account. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The generation of our media, the surrender of Congress, you know, on both parties. But also the fact that our judiciary has become dramatically more politicized. And I think it's fair to say that there's rarely, if ever, been so politicized a choice for the Supreme Court as Brett Kavanaugh. This is a guy who literally, you know, kind of earned his spurs, if you will, as a hack, you know, at the center of, or very, I shouldn't say at the center of, in a very important role with the Bush v. Gore recount in Florida in 2000. I mean, it's a guy who, you know, proved himself by helping to steal the presidency.
Did you say steal the presidency, John?
Setting up the theft of the presidency? What's your proper term there?
No, I just wanted you to reiterate.
Yeah, all I've done is in 2000, Al Gore won the popular vote. Al Gore, at the very least, got Florida to a tie. And depending on, you know, a variety of recount scenarios, would have won. There are obviously people who say there's other recount scenarios he would have lost. But if you look at them, there's many, many scenarios. I wrote a book on it. I looked at the ballots. I looked at the...
Was that Jews for Buchanan?
It was.
Uh-huh.
And I came to the conclusion that if you're an honest person, if you're not a liar, but if you're an honest person, you have to accept that the only reason George Bush became president of the United States was because of horrible ballot design that led, you know, literally elderly Jews who were very Democratic to vote for Pat Buchanan for president. Well, that didn't happen. You know, that's not a that didn't happen by choice. That was a, at the very least, a muddled, mangled, dysfunctional election. And there should have been a full recount. It should have been the most thoroughgoing recount in American history because it was about the presidency itself. And the Bush legal team, in combination with the Bush family and Secretary of State Catherine Harris and a variety of other folks, delayed, interrupted, messed with the process to a point where finally a narrow majority on the U.S. Supreme Court came in and shut down the recount process. I don't know what you want to call that, the borrowing of the presidency, you could call it. I happen to say it's
Would you put what Mitch McConnell did to Barack Obama's last pick, Merrick Garland, in the same category?
No, I've got to give McConnell credit for going to a higher level. Yeah, what McConnell did was almost beyond, you know, I mean, McConnell went to a point of not just, you know, arguing an emergency, which was, by the way, the argument for the Bush v. Gore intervention on the part of the court essentially was that it was an emergency situation. They had to shut stuff down because America had to get a president out of this process. The timeline was running, right? And so in addition to all the other arguments, they had one of, you know, we got to settle this thing. McConnell didn't do that. McConnell just said, nope, I'm going to sit on this thing for a year, you know, until I get a president I can work with. And it's a much higher level, I should say, a much higher level of conniving, even than some of the Bush v. Gore people.
And he was willing to absorb all the insults and ridicule from the president because he's getting ultimately what he wants, and that's a right-wing judiciary.
Look, when the history of this time is written, if it's an honest history...
What an ugly chapter.
Well, it's an ugly chapter, but I'll tell you something else. It's going to be the story of Mitch McConnell defining the United States to a much greater extent than the presidents who happened to pass through. And he is the constant figure in this country at this point.
It's getting harder for him to go out to dinner in Louisville.
Yeah, well,
Where are the babies, Mitch?
I actually think Mitch should be able to have an Italian dinner. I'm amazed that he's going to Italian restaurants. That's pretty exotic for him. I had no idea he ate that. I would have thought, like Mitch McConnell would be sort of like white bread with a little, you know, Kraft Velveeta. I just didn't see him as a, you know, like...
Oh, my God.
Chicken cacciatore kind of guy.
So this is pretty remarkable because there are some people, the Morning Joe crew, the morning after Kavanaugh was picked, they were sort of fawning over them, saying that this is the Democrats' own fault that they're in this situation, and you can't criticize this guy's academic and judicial credentials, and that he pretty reasonable pick.
You can't criticize this guy's academic credentials. So what? Like, if you graduated from a good college, that's it? You know what I mean? I acknowledge that Brett Kavanaugh is smart. That's what scares me. He is smart. He's calculating and conniving. He's going to go before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's going to put in a performance just like Gorsuch. You know, I didn't even know there were two parties in America. Really? What are their names? Liberal? What's that? Conservative? You know, I mean, it's just, you know what he's going to do. He's going to be, it's like a sudden explosion of unimaginable ignorance. The guy they're going to be telling you is the smartest guy in the world isn't going to know anything, right? And he's going to be good at that, I'm sure. And he'll go, I guarantee you, he'll be up there, you want to talk about youth softball? Glad to talk. I know a lot about softball. You know? And he'll take a lot of softball questions.
How is it that Republicans find Catholic justices that are so anti-social justice. I mean,
yeah,
isn't that
you? Might you've got more?
I'm Catholic.
So. Than myself. You tell me. You know, look, it is a sad reality, right? Because there was a period in the 80s and the 90s when Cardinal Bernardin and frankly Catholic leaders from around the world tried to advance the vision of a seamless garment, i.e., they said, yes, Catholic Church is pro-life, i.e., it's opposed to abortion, but it's also opposed to the death penalty. It does take some conservative stance on a host of social issues, but it also believes that there must be a bias on the side of the poor, that, you know, our leaders must, you know, care for the least among us economically, those who are in the most struggling of situations. It had essentially, at its best, a bias against, you know, certainly against unnecessary wars, a bias in favor of diplomacy. You know what I mean? There was the seamless garment notion.
A bias in favor of labor rights?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, yeah. So this seamless garment notion, it didn't mean that everybody was going to agree with everything, but it did suggest that there was a way that you put all these things together, right? And what we now have, one of the criticisms, right, was that you used to hear, and I know you've heard this term, the notion of a cafeteria Catholic.
Uh-huh.
Right? Some of you picked the things they liked, things they didn't like, and that was usually aimed at
liberal Catholics.
Liberals. Yeah. But now you've got a cafeteria Catholic who doesn't pick from the whole social gospel. And, you know, in fact, has been a part of an awfully lot of stances that have been extremely harmful to working class folks and to poor folks. Kavanaugh is certainly not alone in that. And also, I'm personally very uncomfortable, profoundly uncomfortable, with people that are going to go after him on religion. I don't think that many will, but I also don't think that's a very good
idea. But I see a pattern, and I don't think people should go after him, but it's perplexing to me that these people that go to Jesuit schools appear to be, that the Republicans pluck out. I don't know if it's a strategy, because over the years, there's a long history of Donald Trump making rather anti-Catholic statements. So it's interesting that he picked Kavanaugh, but I think authoritarianism probably weighed against everything else.
I'm going to tell you, I don't think that Donald Trump spent a lot of time worrying about Brett Kavanaugh's religion, and I don't think the rest of us should either. I think what we should worry about is what this guy has clearly signaled are his stances as regards one of the most vital issues that the court deals with, and that is, you know, basically whether we have a system of checks and balances in this country. Now, that's not to put aside all the other issues that people will organize around and people care about, and which I think are absolutely vital, you know, whether the established law of Roe v. Wade is maintained, whether the established law as regards LGBTQ rights is maintained, whether established law as regards affirmative action is maintained. These are vital battles, right? But we ought to also include on that, as we run our list of things that concern us, the fact that we've got a guy kind of headed toward the Supreme Court at this point who appears by his own writings and by his own statements and by his own background to be quite committed to an expansion of presidential powers that goes very much at odds with what the founders of the American experiment intended, and frankly, with what I think any reasonable American would want.
The grounds in which he is opposed. Let me just pick a story that I found this morning. In 2005, a group of workers at a meatpacking plant in Brooklyn joined a union. Their employer, a kosher meat wholesaler called Agriprocessor, fought the organizing effort, but they formed a union anyway. Ultimately, neither the National Labor Relations Board nor the majority of judges for the U.S. Court of Appeals in the district in D.C. agreed with the meat processor. Their argument was that these workers couldn't form a union because they weren't documented workers. and that they wouldn't be covered under collective bargaining. Guess who the one judge who dissented was?
Kavanaugh.
Yeah, it would be Brett Kavanaugh.
And what was his reasoning for that?
His reasoning was that they wouldn't be considered valid workers under the National Labor Relations Act.
Because of their citizenship status.
Uh-huh.
So here's the interesting thing. You know a little bit about labor history.
Not as much as you.
Well, but you and I think will be honoring our friend Ed Sedlowski Sr. soon.
Indeed.
Down in Chicago, one of the great, great epic figures in American labor history. Came out of the Steelworkers Union. One of the great steelworkers locals in the 1930s was over in Youngstown, Ohio. To this day, I think they refer to it as the All Nations local. And I remember covering labor issues in Ohio decades ago. And even then, the point that they made was that when this huge union local was organized back in the 30s, there were something like 28 languages. There are dozens of languages that were spoken, you know, among its membership. And a tremendous number of the people who were organized were recent immigrants, you know, folks who had come from all over the world from many, many backgrounds. And if you were to establish the standard that someone who is working in an American workplace, who is paying their taxes, who is, you know, following, who's under, by any measure, under U.S. labor law, cannot organize a union, right, cannot have a voice in that workplace, but somehow they're separated out in that one area when everything else, you know, again, every other thing is I's dotted and T's crossed. I mean, then essentially what you're doing is saying, we're glad to have these immigrant workers, that's fine, but we're not glad to treat them as equal. We're not glad to treat them as a part of this whole in the workplace. And what that does, of course, in addition to sowing divisions, right, and you know, kind of pulling people apart from one another rather than trying to have some sort of unity, is it creates a class of workers who, by their nature, you know, just by the nature of this decision, can always be exploited.
Are you talking about a situation where Trump Tower was built with the Polish immigrants?
Well, a situation. Sly, do you know what would happen if you took immigrant workers out of this country? You know, I mean, and people who are in, you know, various stages along their journey to citizenship, right? Recent citizens, folks who are in the process, folks who are working here with a work permit, folks who are, you know, maybe they've got, you know, maybe there's a little bit of gray area about, you know, how they've arrived or how they're going to be treated. And these folks are Irish and Polish, and they come from Latin America and from Africa and from all over the world. They drive our cabs. They cook our food. They work on our dairy farms. You know, I mean, if you're going to start to say people who've come to what John F. Kennedy referred to as a nation of immigrants, can somehow be economically exploited, end up, you know, basically working, I mean, doing a lot of work, but that they can, you know, sort of officially be exploited economically because of decisions like Kavanaugh's, I mean, you really go against basic premises of the American experience.
Well, of course, Kavanaugh lost in that case.
I know, but, I realize that,
right.
But you understand that Brett Kavanaugh, right, every dissent he ever wrote is as important as every majority opinion,
right,
or every successful opinion he ever wrote. Because if he becomes a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, do you know what U.S. Supreme Court justices have an ability to do with a little bit of cajoling and a little bit of lobbying among their fellow justices? They have an ability to make dissents the law of the land.
Explain.
Well, Samuel Alito came to the U.S. Supreme Court as a militant anti-labor activist, right? From the minute he got on that court, he was writing decisions that said, you know what, I really want to get at
mm-hmm.
the dues, right? You know,
which led to the Janus decision.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He was basically begging, you know, bring me a case, I can do this.
Bruce Rauner obviously gave him.
Right, and this is not uncommon. Similarly, what I'm saying is they can take opinions that are not the accepted opinion, not the settled law of the country, and advocate, because these are conservative judicial activists, advocate for the advancement of those views.
Wait a minute. They say they're calling balls and strikes.
Yeah, and they're calling them every time for their side. Yeah, absolutely they are.
You're on a roll today. All right, in summation here today, Councillor Nichols, two things. A, shouldn't Brett Kavanaugh be fought not just on abortion rights, which is very important, and I'm not taking anything away from the Roe v. Wade threat, but considering that Donald Trump has now appointed two anti-worker justices, one potential justice, shouldn't the Democrats be talking about that this guy's not good for workers? Second of all,
bottom line. I give credit to the pro-choice community, right? They're organized. They're ready to speak up. They're ready to identify the issues, make noise about it. I give credit to the civil liberties community, and there's a tremendous number of people concerned about Kavanaugh and civil liberties. They're organized. They're prepared to identify the issues, to identify the concerns, and speak up. It is also important, right, that other groupings, environmental groups, labor groups, basically defenders of the Constitution who actually believe in a system of separation of checks and balances, that they also speak up. And frankly, farm groups, ag groups that are concerned about monopolies in rural America, things like that. Here's why. You want to put together a palette, a whole host of issue concerns, and you want to give those senators from red states, be these Democrats and Republicans, Republicans sometimes from blue states, but who are possible swing votes, like a Collins from Maine, but also Democrats like Tester in Montana and Donnelly in Indiana, Manchin in West Virginia, Heitkamp in North Dakota. You want to give them a variety of issues to pick from, right? So that they can say, when they oppose Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, that there's a lot of concerns on privacy rights, on women's rights, on LGBTQ rights, but here's one that's of particular interest to me because I represent North Dakota, or I represent Montana, or I represent Maine. And so, you know, this is just working with the process, right? It is understanding mm-hmm. that you're going to connect with different people in different ways. You never, ever play games with it. Right to choose is vital and upfront. LGBTQ rights are vital and upfront. Immigrant rights should be vital and upfront. There's a host of these issues that you don't downplay them, but you do bring other issues
right
into
all right
the orbit.
As far as the strategy to try to defeat this man, what do you think? Which route do you think the Democrats should go?
I think their route should be to secure their caucus. They should make it very, very clear that, you know, this is really a vital vote. And, you know, you've got a number of members who are going to look at, you know, they're looking at their own reelection. You understand that. But they're also maybe even more cautious members for a variety of reasons. You ought to respect those members and talk to them a lot. Work with them, not just in a hectoring way or a badgering way, but really try to make the core arguments on why this needs to happen. Because remember, if one Democrat or two Democrats goes off on this thing, if they go over to backing Kavanaugh, the strategy doesn't work, right? It begins to fall apart. So you need, the first step is, it's on Schumer, it's on Durbin, it's on, you know, the leadership of that caucus to hold their caucus together. Parallel to that, there has to be a smart, focused, state-based outreach to the Republicans who might swing. Now, in reality, I think there's only two, but there's people who might suggest there's a few more. The bottom line is that you have to have a strategy that speaks to Susan Collins, not about Washington, but about Maine, about, you know, why people in Maine should be particularly opposed to this nominee. To speak to Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, why people in Alaska should be particularly opposed. And this is one of the problems of our politics. There's too frequently, when you have a fight like this, you have sort of big national messaging coming out of, a couple blocks in D.C. That's not going to make it work. What's going to work is, a real understanding, top to bottom, of why this nomination is a bad nomination for North Dakota or Maine or Alaska. That kind of targeted, smart, issue-based mm-hmm. thinking is necessary because if, as an example, if a Heidi Kuykamp does decide to vote no, you want her to be shored up in that. If a Susan Collins does decide to vote no, you want her to be shored up in that. You don't want, her to go out. I would venture to say is you don't want to describe it as a courageous decision. You want to describe it as a logical decision.
Right. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.